Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The coronavirus attack comes to feel like the nearest thing to a world war. The people of the planet at the mercy of an invisible bat virus, counting each of us on our immune systems and very little in the way of common defense. The U.S. is now the epicenter of the coronavirus epidemic as it spins toward plague standing, up toward the wreckage and transformation that came with HIV/AIDS, with the Spanish flu of 1918, and the bubonic ancestor of all modern plagues. We are counting this hour on the singular reporter, Laurie Garrett, a paragon of knowledge-based journalism, seeing epidemics for herself in huts and hospitals all over the globe, 30 epidemics in 40 years, and writing with precision about the coming plague that is now upon us. Laurie Garrett has won all the big prizes for her work, the Polk, the Peabody, the Pulitzer. We are privileged to engage her this week from her apartment in Brooklyn.
There is a crucial set of time points that are why we're in the disaster we're in now, with a global pandemic with no end in sight and likely to involve every single country on the planet and have devastating effects everywhere it goes. And really, the crucial period is from New Year's Eve, our time, Western New Year's Eve, until the third week of January. During that period, in the two most powerful countries in the world, several missteps, lies, and deliberate obfuscations were made that put the whole world at risk. In China, it was that the general mode of response to the emergence of the disease was to deny that it was a problem, to claim that it was all just about an animal market, which they had closed and therefore end a problem, to send false case reports to the World Health Organization, to constantly insist to WHO that the situation was under control, there was nothing to worry about, don't look at the man behind the curtain. And even as we now know, Xi Jinping steps in and takes over on January 7th, saying, this is really serious. So he knew something that was not known to the rest of the world. He was aware it was a much more out of control, dangerous crisis brewing in Wuhan, and that it had already spread beyond Wuhan. But even as he's doing this, and he starts switching the power structure around and moving different Communist Party bosses in positions to try and bring the situation under control, they're still telling the world there's nothing to worry about. But of course, if I could see with my modest resources that this was not true, and that in fact this was a really dangerous situation brewing, and that they were jimmying with the numbers, and that they were reporting falsehoods to WHO. If I could see that, then certainly our intelligence community could. And while we only sort of presume that to be the case at the time, we now know from multiple reports that indeed our CIA, our National Security Council, a variety of different intel services, and also inside our military, we're all, you know, antennae alert, aware something was happening, and quite concerned, and that this was passed up the chain, trying to bring it to the attention of the president. And by the third week of January, there's a singular moment when the whole tide of the epidemic changes. And at that moment, certain decisions could have been made that would perhaps still have resulted in a big outbreak in China, but not much more than that. That is, on January 19th, Xi Jinping tells his top party leadership, I want an end to all the cover-up. I want an end to all the lies. The time has come. This is too serious. We have to tell the truth. We have to let the outside world know our real numbers. Enough already. He chops the heads off, figuratively, of most of the leadership in Wuhan and Hubei province, brings in trusted party bosses, the former mayor of Shanghai and so on, to take command. And the next day, January 20th, suddenly it looks like there's been this giant surge in the number of cases in China. But of course, these weren't newly infected overnight. Mm. These were simply case reports that they'd been sitting on in the big cover-up, and now suddenly they're telling the truth. They're releasing all the numbers, all the cases to the World Health Organization. So that by January 21st, everybody can see this is a big deal.
Speak of our side of the planet. Our president responded, as so many people have, even through the ages, with denial and then disinformation. He made it a story of borders. The doctrine became keep that virus out, almost laughable in hindsight. How did this happen?
When WHO issues the announcement that, yes, there is this giant problem in China, here are the new numbers, and this leads to a declaration of a public health emergency of international concern. In that time frame, one of the major messages coming from World Health Organization Director General Tedros is, you do not respond to this by isolating nations. You do not respond to this by canceling plane trips and shutting down airports. But barely had he made that announcement in Geneva, then Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, announces that the United States is cutting off all flights from the Wuhan area, from Hebei, and considering all flights from all of China, is recommending that no further Americans travel to China, and is planning an airlift to bring American citizens out of the Wuhan area.
Did it make sense or not?
Well, it was an attitude that reflected a misconception, to be very polite, that one can hold off epidemics in the age of globalization by holding off airplane trips. Doesn't work, never has worked, but certainly we knew in 2009 with the H1N1 flu that not one single incident of barring air flight landings or closing airports or screening by nationality prevented the global spread of that virus in 6 months to every single part of the planet. Mm. So in the age of globalization, all you can do with an airport closure is maybe buy yourself a few days. But here's the problem. The first case from Wuhan was already in the United States by then, already circulating in Snohomish County north of Seattle.
Right.
And the Seattle outbreak was already beginning at that time. So the horse was out of the barn, and we actually know now that many of the outbreaks that we see across the United States had to have been already started. There had to have been isolated infected individuals in multiple locations around the United States by the time the president is saying, I'm going to pull up the drawbridge to the castle, fill the moat with water, and try to hope the virus doesn't swim.
Yeah, then comes delusion and a lot of disinformation. Second week in March, he said his best decision was the very early decision to stop travel from certain parts of the world. And Larry Kudlow, economist, says for the White House, we closed it down, we stopped it. A very early shutdown. How do we explain that?
Well, even now, as we finally have admission out of the White House that there could be up to 240,000 people dying in the United States before this particular round of the epidemic is played out in North America, and that's if we do everything right.
Right.
Even now, the president reiterates constantly that we bought time with this airport shutdown. Now, there's been several studies published now in very prestigious scientific literature such as Nature and Science that shows that the airport shutdowns all over the world had no impact of any significance in slowing the spread of this virus anywhere in any country, anywhere in the world, including the United States. But even if we want to give the president credit and say, yeah, you bought us time, what did you do with that time? Did you take that time, you claim this extra 3 or 4 weeks you bought America by shutting down airports and airplane flights and barring travelers, did you build up a defense system that put America in a better position to fight this virus during that precious time? And the answer, of course, is no.
How did you dope out the how bad question? It was bad, of course, before we knew anything about it, before I did. How much worse than the bad seasonal flu year, as people were saying? What was the tipping point into immeasurably bad?
Well, for quite a long time, there were officials in the government, all the way up to the president himself, who were comparing COVID-19 to influenza and claiming that in terms of its impact, it would be no worse than an average flu season. The president expressed great surprise after one of his briefings with Dr. Anthony Fauci to learn that flu kills people every year in America. He didn't seem to have known that, even though apparently his own grandfather died of influenza in America. You know, there was this sense that, well, all right, so maybe there is an epidemic, but it's really not a big deal. And as the economy and Wall Street responded with greater and greater uncertainty and fear, reflected in what became one of the most severe market so-called corrections in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. Even as that is playing out, you increasingly have top financial advisors and many commentators, pundits that the president listens to, saying the death toll from the economic damage, the economic carnage, will be worse than the virus. We should just let this virus do its thing. And sure, some people will die, but we'll keep the economy alive. We shouldn't close businesses. We shouldn't do the social distancing practices that will be so painful because, you know, more Americans will die as a result of losing their jobs.
Right.
Or seeing their general economic strength of their community collapse than would have been the case with the virus. So you began to see a whole narrative that pitted fighting the virus against fighting to save the economy. And again, there were indications that at first Wall Street was buying this because after such statements, the market would come back up a bit. And the Fed would inject money into the market that, of course, is not real money. It's all borrowed against future generations and attempt to buoy the market. This goosing of the market was done by central banks all over the world. It wasn't unique to the United States. And everywhere it was done, it may have slowed the descent. It may have prevented, you know, a full-scale 24-hour collapse of a market in any given country. But in the long run, you know, all over the world, markets are showing anywhere from 15 to 30% drops since New Year's Day.
Coming up, two men, in Laurie Garrett's view, who created the conditions of maximum public health breakdown. This is Open Source. In Laurie Garrett's first draft of coronavirus history so far, two men bestride the stage with outsized power, authoritarian instincts, a need for control that leads them both in zigzag directions. Here's how she came to that judgment.
So for decades, I've been tracking rumors and hints of outbreaks around the world. And then if something seemed to be a bona fide potential to go beyond a short-term outbreak into a full-fledged epidemic, I have tried for many years to go to the site. And I've been in more than 30 epidemics over the course of my career. All over the world, the only continent I haven't been on in an outbreak is Antarctica. And there are certain things that over the years you realize you have to pay attention to. And one of them is winter China respiratory disease. Over and over and over, we've seen outbreaks begin with scattered reports of people coughing, of high fevers, hospitalizations in the wintertime in China. And in the past, they've tended to be about bird flus, H5N1, H7N9, these very, very dangerous forms of influenza that are very deadly to certain types of birds, especially chickens, and on the rare occasion when they jump to humans, prove to be extremely lethal. One of them kills 60% of the human beings it infects. So I'm always paying attention, trying to see what's going on, and we started getting rumors before Christmas out of Wuhan of some kind of an incident, some kind of disease. There are certain services now that didn't exist back when I started doing all this that track these things. One of them is called ProMed, and it's run by the Federation of American Scientists, and they track media reports and social media to see what rumors are flying that may be relevant. And they were all over this Wuhan thing. They seemed to see quite a number of claims that there were people with an unusual pneumonia. Well, the last time we had a really serious unusual pneumonia was SARS. And everything, since I had been in the SARS epidemic in China and Hong Kong in 2003, and then I'd gone back and looked at what happened with SARS in Vietnam, Thailand, and Singapore. So I was very immediately tuned in. If this is SARS, we have a real problem on our hands. Mm. So I was really paying attention to everything I could find, including in the Chinese media, including state-run media. And between the week of Christmas and New Year's, there started to be a real escalation in the rumors. And then December 30th, a physician named Li Wenliang posted in a chat room that he thought it looked like SARS. And that jumped from the chat room into the general rumor mill, social media. And as everybody now knows, Li Wenliang and seven other physicians he worked with were all reprimanded and forced to sign confessions to being liars and rumor mongers.
Laurie Garrett, come to the striking point in your incredibly interesting long piece in the New Republic, just out, that this is a story of two men rather strikingly mirroring each other, both strong tendency toward autocratic rule, surrounded by sycophants, both captains of gigantically ambitious empires, and with enormous power, they chose at critical moments to deny obliviousness, defensiveness, suppression, control, as you write, was the mantra they shared in everything. The coronavirus is very much under control in the USA, Trump had tweeted back in February. It's a story of vanity, of illusion, too much power at the top. Spell that out, and then where it diverges.
On the world stage today, the two most powerful men are Xi Jinping and Donald J. Trump. These are the leaders of the two largest economies, with the two most massive military forces, with fingers, both of them, in more than 60 nations around the world, at the command of giant alliances and economic coalitions around the world, and capable of both damaging and helping the planet in remarkable ways if they choose. In 2007, was it the Paris Peace Climate Accord? The Paris Climate Plan happened only when the United States and China decided to bury the hatchet long enough to jointly push an initiative for capping CO2 emissions and then rolling back CO2 emissions nation by nation with individual nation plans. That would never have happened, and India would never have been swayed to finally buckle under and sign if it hadn't been China and the United States. Angela Merkel could scream all she wanted, but Germany just didn't have the power to push. And the same with Shinzo Abe, and the same with Emmanuel Macron, and so on. It really came down to the moment when the two powerful leaders said, all right, let's do this thing. Now, that was Obama and Xi Jinping. Now we have, you know, Xi Jinping is the most powerful leader China has had since Mao Zedong himself.
Right.
He forced the constitution of China to be changed, incorporating one of his own personal essays into the constitution as having the strength and power of a constitutional document. This is a man for whom loyalty is an absolute, and the structure and nature of the bureaucracy has been utterly transformed. It was the case in the past, when I was there during SARS, for example, and Hu Jintao was the leader of the country. You know, your big complaint was that it kind of had two governments at once. You had the out front faces of the Ministry of X, the mayor of Y, you know, the titles, the governing titles. And then you had the shadow government that was all Communist Party, and often with seemingly lesser posts or job titles that made no sense. But they were the real power, and you had to figure out who they were and find the shadows. Today, what Xi Jinping has done is so completely take over the government that the shadow and the government face are all blended. And absolute loyalty to the CCP is mandatory for any sort of advancement at all, in any career, anywhere in all of China.
You're making a case study, in a certain way, Laurie Garrett, of two giant countries with incredibly controlling, sensitive, difficult, authoritarian chiefs who got us into this horrific thing. But you also see ways that they could somehow do penance, not make us whole, but make amends. Explain that. And let me just also note that you quote a marvelous writer, Feng Feng, Exhibit A of a certain civic spirit in China, too, who writes that the government wants gratitude. Incredible. Feng Feng says, I find this way of thinking very strange. Our government is supposed to be a people's government. It exists solely to serve the people. Government officials work for us, not the other way around. I don't understand why our leaders seem to draw exactly the opposite conclusion. What could Xi Jinping and Donald Trump do, together or on their own?
Well, first of all, Feng Feng has now been imprisoned.
Uh-oh.
So her essays got her in deep trouble. Secondly, the demand for gratitude was also made by Donald Trump, who
of course
said he wanted to help governors who said they were thankful to him and to his administration and didn't want to help governors, such as, he noted, the governor of Michigan, who failed to show appropriate gratitude and to say thank you. So this is another of many traits that the two fearless leaders share. I mean, I would be happy to push all of that aside, forget all of their many frailties and errors, if they would come together and jointly declare that the goal is to immunize the entire planet, rich and poor alike, no matter how remote a person's existence may be, no matter where they may be, in a campaign that would be seven times larger than what was accomplished with the eradication of smallpox.
Hmm.
Now, it was 1966, the height of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union put forward a motion at the World Health Assembly, the governing body of WHO, saying, we call for the eradication of smallpox. The United States, their arch enemy, seconded it, and together they led what became the most successful public health effort in world history. And in 11 years, eradication was completed. That's
right.
You know, phenomenal, and that involved going to some of the most difficult remote parts of the planet, into the middle of war zones, all sorts of very, very difficult settings. But it was accomplished. Now, the only way we will get rid of this virus is if we mass vaccinate the whole planet, not just Americans, not just Chinese, not just Germans, the whole damn planet. And if we're going to do that, it's going to require a scale that has never been attempted in history. Nothing we have ever done, not even the moonshot, would come close. And it would require that the United States and China jointly lead such an effort, marshaling the commercialization resources for mass production of affordable vaccine, marshaling the financing for an army of several million people to go out and vaccinate the planet, and leading the charge regarding such things as voiding patents and understanding that nobody's going to get rich off this.
I was just going to say, Laurie, I'm so glad you mentioned that incredible burst in the 20th century of antibiotics. You mentioned smallpox, but also polio, HIV, AIDS, too, among them. Incredible urgency on the pharmacological side. But there's been a revolution since then in Big Pharma. That is not what Big Pharma does. And the question is, are we up to that task, not just of finding a vaccine, but of developing it, marketing it, distributing it?
Well, I would say this is the come-to-Jesus moment for the pharmaceutical industry. And I mean that internationally, not just Americans. And I mean that as both the patent industry and the generic industry. Either they rise to this task, or their legitimacy as a force of curative medicine is over. Because they have garnered record profits. they have become, you know, the darling of Wall Street and the darling of the Hang Seng and the darling of every single major trading market. And they have done so by going away from making vaccines, going away from curative medicine towards chronic management of lifelong ailments with things like statins to control your cholesterol, and even turning cancer into a chronic treatment model at a cost of, say, $250,000 a year. And these things are, there's an end limit to that. You're no longer part of the legitimate arsenal of medicine if you ignore something like the COVID-19 pandemic and fail to rise to the challenge with not only production facilities and safe, accurate, specific vaccine production and hopefully cures as well, but also, you know, pushing the profit motive off to one side for a modest profit to be made off of a product that would be available and affordable even in the poorest countries on the planet. We don't get anywhere. We don't accomplish anything with this disease if we only vaccinate the rich countries.
Meantime, let me ask, what do we do with riddles like, and they're urgent, hydroxychloroquine, which will be is offered as a maybe miracle? How many things like that are we going to have to try and beware of, maybe?
Well, there's going to be, there already have been, and there will continue to be, multiple drugs put out with claims, many at a time, false claims of their efficacy. People will, in desperation, try them. Hydroxychloroquine is just one of a long list. There are more than 69 pharmaceuticals that have been identified based on artificial intelligence analysis of the actual ways that the drugs act on microbes and what might be their logical targeting. And, you know, there will be ups and downs with many of them. But it doesn't help if a politician who doesn't know any biology jumps in and starts promoting a specific drug. Then you have a run on the market for that drug. You have a lot of people being given the medicine based on little or no medical science whatsoever. And it's not available to those who have the bona fide diseases for which the drug is made. And in the case of hydroxychloroquine, you know, we're running out of the global supply of this very important part of the arsenal of malaria treatment. And as more and more of COVID-19 hits sub-Saharan Africa, the combination of a shortage on a vital drug for treatment of malaria and prevention of malaria, plus its use in a different context that may be substandard and promote drug-resistant parasites, renders the whole future of malaria control in peril.
Before we let Trump and Xi Jinping go, I had this fantasy of the two of them going to Tehran, which has been badly hit by all of this, and making a sort of summit, game-changing moment that we're in this thing together. We're seeing a lot of the folly that we had on the drawing board, trade wars with China, war with Iran, all these completely unproductive fantasies. What might they do? Could they go to Tehran together to make a statement?
There are a whole long list of things you could imagine where the two most powerful men on the planet could come together and have a joint Chinese-American initiative. I mean, I would, long before I would do something as far-fetched as marching to Tehran to meet with the Ayatollah, I would say a complete ceasefire in the South China Sea would be called for right now, particularly when two aircraft carriers of the American Pacific Fleet are down with COVID. And, you know, the Chinese have been moving their fleet ever closer to Japanese territorial waters. You know, the number one thing we would love to hear the two leaders jointly declare is, we're ending the blame game. We're ending the accusations and cross-accusations made against each other. There will be no more support from Minister of Foreign Affairs or State Department officials who use racial slurs, who claim that their counterpart is responsible for biological weapons and that that is where this virus came from. There will be zero tolerance for any of this belligerence back and forth between the two countries. That's step one. Step two, Secretary General Antonio Guterres 2 weeks ago called for a total worldwide ceasefire and end all conflicts for the duration of the pandemic. And I thought it was a quite reasonable call. There's nothing, you know, to be gained or lost, right? But it wasn't immediately seconded by the two countries that have the two largest militaries on Earth and are involved in more conflicts than anybody else. And that should have been the case. You know, we would love the moment when the two of them send a petition before the Security Council of the United Nations jointly calling for a total ceasefire for the duration of the pandemic. And instead, neither of them has utilized the Security Council in any way, shape, or form regarding this pandemic at any moment. And the cross-belligerence just continues and just ratchets up ever higher. Now we have alleged leaked reports claiming that, you know, China was lying about their epidemic early on in ways different than I described. And this, you know, we have no way to assess these because these are secret, they're classified. So somebody in the administration is deliberately leaking the news that there were these reports, right?
Okay. Well,
who does that serve? It serves into the fire of this China versus United States war of words.
Right.
And this war of words benefits no one except Xi and Trump. The masses of the planet are not helped in any way, shape, or form by this. You know, the smart play right now, if they weren't acting like spoiled brats, the smart play at this moment would be for those two leaders to shake hands, well, figuratively, because we don't want anybody actually truly shaking hands, but to figuratively shake hands and say, okay, we're putting all of our mutual animosity over to the side for now. There's a higher calling at this moment. We must stop this pandemic.
Coming up, the critical difference between modern medicine and public health. This is Open Source. I am squinting at the big picture with the peerless reporter Laurie Garrett and asking a different sort of question. Does this virus story fit almost too well into the sense we already had of our 2020 condition? Mass helplessness in a digitizing economy? A social system labeled surveillance capitalism, sucking out our privacy and our money, a sort of brave new world that doesn't much recognize individuals or the varieties of our humanity. And here we are suddenly locked down and isolated by a bat virus, knowing that a climate catastrophe is just off stage. It could feel like another metaphor or a new chapter in a book we've all been reading. Does that make sense?
Not really. I'm not quite sure what you're asking me. I didn't hear a question. You know, it's your statement.
Well, it's my feeling. We're getting used to something.
The globalized economy has failed to meet the challenge and proven highly vulnerable to this, you know, singular black swan event. And it's very clear that the major frailty displayed by the event is the supply chain issue related to the ultimate transformation that has taken place in the economy, which is dispersed production, dispersed chains of distribution, and dispersed chains of manufacturing. Much of the panic on Wall Street is really about what is the nature of long-term change in the market. How will global economics work in the future when this is all over? We can see now that it didn't make any sense for the whole world to depend on one country for medical masks, for the whole world to depend on one country for the manufacture of ventilators. And, you know, one of the take-home messages from this whole thing is maybe we need to rethink the nature of distributed manufacturing and production, and maybe we need to rethink how the economy works. Well, another piece of all of that that has clearly been in the background all along has been that the last big shakeup in the economy was the 2008 world financial crisis. And we came out of it with the undesired consequence of an ever greater concentration of the vast majority of global health in the hands of the top 0.5%, less than 1% of the world population. When, you know, a handful of families control 50% of global wealth, the world doesn't work right. It just doesn't function right. You could put aside how you feel about justice, how you feel about the right of some people to be obscenely wealthy compared to everybody else. You know, Jeff Bezos certainly thinks he deserves every penny he's got. But the real issue is it good for the overall functioning of that economy? And the answer obviously is no, because what you've done, even from a cynical you know, money-making point of view, is you've eradicated a huge chunk of your consumer economy,
right,
because they have less and less spending money. And you've laid your whole production chain vulnerable to black swan events like this pandemic. And whether it's a cyclone, you know, in the China Sea, or a giant volcanic eruption in Guatemala, whatever it may be, the disruptions will be there in the future. So I think there's going to be a massive rethink in the whole global economy. And if you put this in comparison to the past major disruptive events, World War I and the 1918 flu ushered a variety of changes that ultimately led to the Great Depression and to the rise of the Weimar Republic and out of that fascism. The Black Death of the 14th century was for many, many centuries referred to not as the Black Death, not as the plague, but as the Great Mortality, almost as if it was unknown why, but a bunch of people evaporated from planet Earth. It was the single most dramatic mortality shift ever recorded in world history in our species. And for Europe, it was, you know, more than a third of the European population disappeared, just about the same ratio for the Middle East and North Africa. And we don't really have good data, but we know it was a massive impact across South Asia, what is now called India, and what is now called China and Mongolia. So what were the outcomes of that? Well, one of the things that changed in Europe was that suddenly there was a dearth of labor. And countries that were divided into tiny fiefdoms ruled by tyrants who claimed their right by virtue of inheritance, but virtually owned their labor force, the serfs, the fiefs that worked for them. And they treated them as poorly as they chose, and demanded much of their crops that they farmed and so on. And all the artisans were essentially owned by their patron. They painted for their patron. They built furniture for their patron. When the Great Mortality had passed and the 1350s unfolded to discover a completely transformed human population across Europe, the whole nature of the relationship between aristocrats and labor was transformed. And you suddenly had the rise of the guilds with demanded payment and demanded treatment. You had farm workers refusing to harvest the fields of the worst aristocrats, the most tyrannical. And you had increasing resistance to required service for mercenary wars fought by one duchy against another, or, you know, one principality against another. And eventually the dissolution of the city-states forming into great nation-states, and then the treatment of Westphalia becomes the ultimate end result of this whole transformation. So I think that we should expect that when this pandemic is over with and we all catch our breath 2 or 3 years from now, we will be in a very different world. And
oh,
it
boy.
Will have changed. It will have changed in many ways that we cannot now imagine.
Lori Garrett, I love the big picture questions. I like the long view, too. But I want to go back to trying to see this as a whole, as it will be seen in history. You wrote 25 years ago in The Coming Plague, you were speaking of a world out of balance. And that's what I'm trying to see, the different pieces out of balance. But back to Trump and Xi Jinping, seems to me the least they could do in a certain way would be to declare mutually that we have met the enemy, which is nature in the end, and we can put all other conflicts sort of in perspective. Also, a humanitarian gesture of those two men would be welcome, but also recognizing simple reality that we've discovered, that our medical system does not defend us. I mean, I don't want to be narrowly political, but Kianga Taylor got off a good line in The New Yorker the other day that reality endorses Bernie Sanders on this matter of universal care. You got to take care of everybody. When you isolate the sick, you sicken everybody sooner or later. So there are lessons to be drawn, and I don't want to be shy about asserting our right to get some answers. Do you know what I'm saying?
You know, a lot of people are saying that, and have said, and I've been in this argument for the last 35, 40 years on emerging diseases, doesn't it all boil down to medical systems? No, it does not. It boils down to public health systems, and they are two different things.
Okay.
You can have a great medical system and have a horrible public health outcome. That's what we're seeing right now, it playing out in much of Europe and much of the wealthy world. So, you know, Italy has one of the best medical systems on earth. And the care in northern Italy in particular is world class. There's nothing lacking in their hospitals for normal routine care. And there's a reason they have a very elderly society. And part of it is because people are fit and they're taken care of and they have excellent, excellent free medical care. So everything Bernie Sanders stands for, they've got. That didn't help them. That has not helped them at all. They are dying like flies. They are dying with a far higher case fatality rate than was experienced in China, that was experienced in Hong Kong, that was experienced in Singapore, that was experienced in South Korea. This is not about medical care. And the failure to understand the difference between medical care and public health is a fundamental problem in the American system. In all our rhetoric, on both sides politically, you know, yes, we should have had full implementation of Obamacare. Yes, everybody should have been covered by the American Care Act. And yes, it would be a good thing for all Americans to have affordable health care. But that would not have stopped this epidemic. That would not have made any difference at all. What would have stopped this epidemic would have been a really strong reinforcement of the Army of Public Health, which has nothing to do with medical care.
Let's talk about it.
I mean, you know, I've written multiple books about this. You've only mentioned one, but my second book, Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health, is, you know, 900 pages explaining this and showing why, you know, medical care and public health were both fat lies in the Soviet Union, and what happened when the public health lie got to be bigger than the medical lie. And similarly, the proud tradition of the rise of public health in America, why in our country we're especially vulnerable but also have, you know, long-standing triumphs to point to, because our public health system is the only one that arose from the grassroots up rather than from the federal top level down. So, you know,
What era are you talking about? I mean, when you say it did rise up from the people in this country, exactly, I mean, just which movement, which time, which problem?
Well, it depends how far back you want to go. Do you want to go to 1600?
Sure.
I mean, public health in the United States grew out of the grassroots level. It was always considered a local activity. Everything that defined public health, even before we had a germ theory of disease, going back to the very first settlements across the various parts of North America, were defined locally. And as we develop an understanding of the germ theory of disease, certain key metropolitan areas, with New York and Boston in the forefront, create absolute systems of public health based on germ theory, so that you have a commissioner of health who's out to get tuberculosis, out to get smallpox, out to control the vectors of disease, to snuff out mosquitoes, and so on. And we end up with a system in the United States today that is a patchwork and a mosaic of legal jurisdictions in which it is the local level that has all the power but none of the money. And it is the federal level that has the money and none of the power. The CDC, which everybody always talks about, actually has almost no legal authority anywhere in the United States of America. It can only actually exert legal authority when allowed to do so by the local authorities, with the exception of certain federal properties such as airports. There's a reason we end up resorting to like airport control, because the CDC cannot march into the middle of Boston and exert authority superseding the local Boston health authorities and the state of Massachusetts. Indeed, federal authority cannot even enter the state without the permission of local authority, which is why the governor of Florida can drag his feet for 3 weeks, allow beaches to stay open, allow transmission of COVID-19 to continue, and ignore everything coming from the CDC, everything coming from other governors, do as he pleases, because he has more power over public health in the state of Florida than any federal authority whatsoever. And so, unlike our counterparts in, say, the UK, or in Canada, or in France, or in China, or in Japan, or pick any country you wish, our federal government has limited authority. Now, what do we expect from our federal government in a crisis like this? Well, we expect them to adjudicate disputes between states and to recommend and set guidelines that all the states can start to follow, to assist states in receiving justly distributed supplies, and to not pit the states against each other. However, Trump has done just the opposite of that. He's told every state, you are all separate purchasers of masks, separate purchasers of ventilators. You set your own health standards. You decide what you want to do. And we may or may not, based on whether or not I like your state and I like your governor and you're the right political party, we may or may not provide you with assistance and supplies as requested. That is not the nature of how it's supposed to work. However, because of our patchwork law, because everything in public health in this country arose from the bottom up, starting in the 1600s and at great pace by the end of the 1800s, because of this, we have always had, you know, extraordinary differences in life expectancy from state to state, huge differences in sexually transmitted disease rates, reproductive health problems, because the states set the standards.
Dr. Fauci has become our sort of embodiment of disinterested public scientific service. Shouldn't we be hearing more from him and people like him? Or why has that message not come through, even with his standing there?
I think Fauci's done a masterful job, as he always has. He's been probably the consummate political scientist or scientist who is political on our stage for, you know, several presidents, going all the way back to Ronald Reagan. And I have seen him outmaneuver one senator after another, one congressman after another, one president after another. And it didn't matter whether the given person coming at him was of the left or the right. Tony goes with the science. And frankly, if we currently had a Democrat in office as President of the United States, and Tony strongly disagreed with that individual, we would be having a conversation about Tony as the conservative force. His own personal politics, he plays tight to the chest, but he is by no means a lefty. By no means would he identify with the Democratic Party. But he knows science, and he believes that you must operate off reductionist empirical principles in making your policy choices, especially when it affects whether or not people live or die. For that, we should all be eternally grateful to Tony. And I think that what you have seen is those moments when you suddenly everybody noticed, where's Tony? And there was a sense of panic. Has Trump pushed Tony out of the picture? What you see is he's always coming back. And the reason is you can't shove Tony out of the picture. And the only scientist who I know in the United States in modern history who I think came close to Tony as a political operator was Josh Lederberg, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But Josh was the founder of the JASNS, the sort of semi-secret classified scientific advisory group that operates inside the White House and the executive branch. And he was the central inspiration for Michael Crichton's Andromeda strain. He was a leading figure in everything to do with biology and the development of biological principles, ethics, and so on in the United States. And I wish we had him to help us right now as well. But Tony is it, and Tony can do the job. And I don't, you know, the fact that it's reached a point where for the first time in Tony's career, he needs Secret Service protection because of death threats is astounding. And that says a lot about where we are as Americans and how horrible it is that everything gets partisan, politicized, even a plague. The virus doesn't know what political party you're in. And it certainly isn't going to not attack you because of your faith or not attack you because of how you cast your ballots.
Laurie Garrett, you are our indispensable reporter in coronavirus time, and it's just beginning. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you, Chris, and stay safe, everybody.
Laurie Garrett's piece in The New Republic is titled Grim Reapers, How Trump and Xi Set the Stage for the Coronavirus Pandemic, online at newrepublic.com. Our quarantine radio show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our virus hunter. I'm Christopher Lydon in isolation. Join us next time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.